Welcome to Hanschuk Targets History. I'm your host, Tim Hanschuk. Thanks for joining me this episode. You know, I've been teaching high school history for way too many years, and I love talking about this stuff. So let me share with you some interesting, unique, and little-known historical events. I know you'll be entertained, and if you're not careful, you just might learn something too. So, let's lock and load and take a shot at that target of history and see what we can hit. All right, let's take a walk down range and see what the target shows us. Huh, looks like today we'll be talking about the ridiculous voyage of the Baltic Fleet. I thought of maybe calling this episode The Comedy of Errors, but old Willie Shakespeare already beat me to that title. Plus, with the tremendous loss of life we'll be seeing, maybe that would have been in poor taste. In 1904, the Russo-Japanese War begins. Russia and Japan had both been looking to expand their influence in the Pacific, Manchuria, and maybe even Korea. There had been bad blood between them for a long time, and the war begins with a Japanese attack on the Russian-held Port Arthur in Manchuria. With the fact that Russia held few land possessions in the Pacific area, a large component of the war will involve each country's navies. The problem here is that with the attack on Port Arthur and early naval losses, the Russian Pacific Fleet, at least what's left of it, is bottled up in port, allowing the Japanese to pour troops into Manchuria for their land campaign. Russia desperately needs to send another fleet to come to the aid of the Pacific one, but therein lies the problem. Because of Russia's geography, and also due to international treaties, they were very limited in their options. Russia's geography is such that their navy had to be divided into three areas of operation. The Pacific Fleet, and they're the ones in need of help, the Black Sea Fleet, and the Baltic Fleet. Logic says the Black Sea Fleet should be the ones to come to the Pacific to help because they're the closest, but that brings in the problem of international treaties. At this time, treaties are in place that very much limit the number and size of ships Russia can place in the Black Sea, and pretty much prevent these ships from sailing past Constantinople. These treaties had been in place to prevent Russia from becoming aggressive in the Mediterranean and potentially disrupting the balance of power in Europe. So the task of rescuing the Pacific Fleet falls upon the Baltic Fleet, who's on the other side of the world. Commanding the Baltic Fleet, now renamed the 2nd Pacific Squadron, but I'm probably just going to call them the Baltic Fleet still because it's easier, but the commander was Admiral Zinovy Petrovich Rozhestvensky. He faces the formidable task of steaming his ships from the Baltic into the Atlantic, down around Africa, across the Indian Ocean, and into the Pacific and the Sea of Japan. We're talking like a voyage of over 18,000 miles. And then when he gets there, actually engaging the Japanese Navy in battle. Not only is the voyage of Rozhestvensky's fleet going to be brutally long, it will also prove to be a logistical nightmare when it comes to figuring out how to refuel and resupply the ships. Unlike the British Navy, and even the U.S. a little bit by this time, Russia does not have bases around the world at which to refuel. To further complicate matters, international naval treaties prevented warships from using the ports of other nations, even friendly ones, to refuel. So Rozhestvensky has to think outside the box to solve this problem. And what he finally decided to do was to charter 60 freighters from the German Hamburg America line. And the idea is that they will meet up with the fleet at various places to refuel and resupply the ships at sea. So what's Rozhestvensky bringing to the fight? What makes up his Baltic fleet? Well, before we get into that, one needs to understand world naval power in the early 1900s. The British Navy still rules the waves, even 100 years after Trafalgar. Although the French and the Germans are starting to catch up, they both have large navies at this time, so those are probably the top three in the world. The United States was expanding right at this time, and they're expanding their navy like crazy, so in a few more years, they too will have one of the world's most formidable fleets. The Italian Navy, while being much smaller than the others, had some of the most technically advanced ships of the time. And oh yeah, the emerging naval power that everyone seemed to overlook was Japan, they built up a large, highly disciplined navy of modern warships whose officers had been trained by the British. So, like, hey, they were learning from the big dog. Where does the Russian navy fit in? On paper, they seem to match up with the likes of France and Germany. But in reality, they were a second-rate naval power in terms of the quality of their warships and the quality of their officer corps. Be that as it may, here's the breakdown of Rozhestvensky's squadron. It's made up of both modern and outdated ships. The first battleship division is going to be all modern ships. Rozhestvensky's flagship was the Prince Suvorov. We also have the Orel, Alexander III, and Borodino. The second battleship division was made up of three older and less heavily armored battleships. There was also the first cruiser division, made up of seven cruisers, and even an old frigate that was actually still rigged for sail. They also had nine destroyers and a handful of support ships, including the fleet repair ship Kamchatka. All in all, there's 42 vessels, which is a sizable group, and it does have the potential for doing some serious damage and finding success, if it's maneuvered and used properly. The next problem for Rozhestvensky to deal with is that he's completely dissatisfied with his senior officers and knew the quality of his crews was substandard. Many of the senior naval officers had risen through the ranks based on family connections rather than skill or merit. Rozhestvensky has little faith in his second-in-command, Rear Admiral Folkersham, referring to him as a sack of manure. He also particularly worried about the skills of the commander of the cruiser division, Rear Admiral Enquist, who he described as a vast empty space. To make matters worse, he also knows that the training of his crews has been poor at best. First of all, most of the sailors in the Baltic fleet were uneducated peasants and didn't even come from coastal areas, so they had no previous experience with any kind of boats or ships. Also remember, the Baltic ports in Russia are iced in for a number of months each winter, making the crews inactive and unable to train. The only training they did during these months was carousing in the bars and getting into trouble. Wow, none of this bodes well for what's coming up. The fleet set sail for Japan on October 11, 1904 from the port of Libau in what is now modern-day Latvia. And the ridiculous problems begin almost immediately. Rozhestvensky's flagship ran aground, and at the same time, one of the cruisers lost its anchor chain. So the entire fleet has to stop and wait for the flagship to be refloated and the cruiser to find its lost anchor and chain. While waiting, one of the destroyers accidentally rammed into one of the older battleships, causing enough damage to force its return to port. Making their way through the Baltic Sea, Rozhestvensky found his officers becoming more and more paranoid. They had heard reports before sailing about the success the Japanese had in the Pacific employing naval mines and using small, fast torpedo boats. Consequently, they feared encountering these things in the Baltic. Yeah, none of them stopped to think of how it would be even remotely possible for Japanese mine layers and torpedo boats, which had a rather limited range, to all of a sudden show up halfway around the world in the Baltic Sea. To quell these fears, Rozhestvensky issued an order stating no vessel of any sort must be allowed to get in amongst the fleet. This new order did nothing to stop the paranoia. As a matter of fact, it caused all the ships to be even more edgy. So when a small vessel was seen directly headed for the fleet, the Russians opened fire. Fortunately for all involved, the horrible gunnery of the Russians failed to hit their target. The vessel turned out to be a Russian fishing ship, specifically sent to catch up with the fleet to give Rozhestvensky a personal message from the Tsar himself, telling him he had been promoted to the rank of Vice Admiral. 10 days into the voyage, the fleet was steaming through Dogger Bank in the North Sea, and here on the night of October 21st, another incident would arise with far more significant ramifications, one that almost plunged Russia into war with Britain. This incident has been ignominiously referred to as the Battle of Dogger Bank. That evening, the supply ship Kamchatka which was last in the Russian line, mistook a passing Swedish ship for a Japanese torpedo boat and signaled the rest of the fleet that they were being attacked until, of course, the Swedish ship sailed away and they realized it was just a false alarm. But this incident did put Russian nerves on edge. Later that night, fog rolled in, making visibility difficult. Duty officers sighted a group of British fishing trawlers and misidentified them as Japanese torpedo boats. Like, dude, these guys were seeing torpedo boats everywhere. Talk about being paranoid. The Russian fleet opened fire. The trawlers had their nets down. I mean, after all, they were fishing. So they couldn't flee. And 20 minutes of absolute chaos ensues. When the craziness ended, the outcome of this battle was this. The British trawler Crane was sunk, and her captain and first mate with her. Four other trawlers were damaged, and six fishermen were wounded, one of whom would die later from his wounds. As for the Russians, during the chaos, the cruisers Aurora and Dmitry Donskoy were mistaken for enemy ships and suffered bombardment from seven of the Russian battleships. Both ships took on major damage, and an Orthodox chaplain and a sailor were killed. Other Russian ships started to signal that they had been hit by torpedoes, even though they hadn't been. And on the Brodno, they thought they were being boarded by the Japanese. Some sailors began to put on life belts, like getting ready to abandon ship, while others ran around on deck waving sabers. Wow, what a fiasco. The only thing that prevented this from being a complete slaughter was the horrendously poor quality of the Russian gunnery. Most of the shots didn't hit a thing. This incident put Russia and Britain in a serious diplomatic situation. Remember, at this time, Britain and Japan were allies. Even though Britain had been neutral in the Russo-Japanese War for the time being, this event could have pulled them into that war. As a matter of fact, 28 British battleships were ordered to begin preparing for action, and squadrons of British cruisers began to shadow the Russians as they steamed through the Bay of Biscay and along the Portuguese coast. The Russian government was under enormous diplomatic pressure and agreed to investigate the incident. As a result, Rozhestvensky was ordered to dock in the Spanish port of Vigo to offload all the officers who were considered responsible for the incident so they could be sent back to Russia to be investigated. Rozhestvensky also used this opportunity to quickly recall his ships from the German freighters right there in the harbor. By the way, the Spanish were not real happy with them. From there, the fleet's plan was to go to Tangiers, Morocco. During this leg of their voyage, they lost contact with the supply ship Kamchatka for a few days. When the Kamchatka rejoined the fleet, it claimed to have encountered three Japanese warships and fired over 300 shells at them. In reality, these ships were a Swedish merchantman, a German trawler, and a French schooner. Good thing the gunners aboard the Kamchatka were so lousy, otherwise we might have had some more diplomatic incidents. Now, the reason the fleet went to Tangiers was that that was where they'd be splitting up into two groups. The plan is this. The modern battleships had a large draft, even more so than was originally designed. So there were concerns that they wouldn't be able to use the Suez Canal. So Rozhestvensky would take these ships along with some of the cruisers and other support ships down and around Africa. Meanwhile, Rear Admiral Fulkersham would take the older, smaller battleships, the rest of the cruisers, and some more of the support ships across the Mediterranean and through the Suez Canal. Both groups were to meet up at Madagascar after their respective journeys. On November 3rd, both groups left Tangiers to go their separate ways. As they were leaving, one ship accidentally cut the city's underwater telegraph cable with her anchor, disrupting communications with Europe for the next 4 days. At this point in our story, we'll stick with Rozhestvensky and the group traveling around Africa. Their next step was to meet up with the German supply ships off Dakar in West Africa to take on more coal. Humidity was high and temperatures remained well over 100 degrees as the Russian sailors spent 29 hours of grueling work to take on double loads of coal for fear that supplies might be low by the time they rounded South Africa and reached Madagascar. The extra coal was actually stored on deck, which caused coal dust to spread throughout the ships. This coal dust, combined with the high humidity, caused numerous sailors to suffer respiratory problems. Some even died. On December 29, 1904, Rozhestvensky's group reached Madagascar, and the situation became even more ridiculous. He himself fell gravely ill and was confined to bed in his cabin for a number of days. His chief of staff suffered a mild stroke that left him partially paralyzed. While waiting for Rozhestvensky to recover and for the other group, who was inexplicably late, to rendezvous with them, most of the sailors spent their time ashore in bars, gambling houses, and brothels. Hey, they had time to kill. You gotta do something, or someone. Even the officers were wasted much of the time. One officer bought 2,000 opium-laced cigarettes, which he generously shared with his friends. Dude, I'm not sure that would be believable even in a Cheech and Chong movie. In this tropical climate, diseases such as malaria, dysentery, and typhus began to take their tolls on the crews, with deaths becoming more and more common. During the funeral for one of the dead sailors, the Kamchatka fired a salute. Unfortunately, one of the shells they used was a live round, and it hit the Aurora, causing some damage. Poor Aurora, man. To try to get the situation back on track, Rozhestvensky ordered some gunnery practice. The destroyers went first, but after firing numerous volleys, not a single shot hit the stationary target. The battleships then took their turn, shooting at a ship-towed target. Only Rozhestvensky's flagship, the Prince Suvorov, scored a single hit. Unfortunately, not on the target, but rather on the ship towing the target. On the 9th of January, 1905, the group coming through the Suez Canal rendezvoused with Rozhestvensky, and the entire fleet set out across the Indian Ocean and into the Pacific by May of 1905. That's a long journey. Wait, nothing ridiculous happened in the Indian Ocean? No, surprisingly not. Rozhestvensky's objective was to maneuver his fleet through the Sea of Japan and up to Vladivostok, take out the Japanese Navy, free up the Pacific fleet that was bottled up in Port Arthur, and basically save the day. In other words, be the knight in shining armor. To enter the Sea of Japan, though, he had three straits from which to choose. He chose Tsushima Strait because it was the easiest and most direct route. It passed between Japan and Korea. Of course, this was the route the Japanese suspected he would take as well, so they parked their fleet there to wait for him. The Russians arrived on May 27th, and thus began the Battle of Tsushima Strait, which would last into the following day. Surprisingly, the Russian gunnery was better than could be expected, but that made little difference against a far better trained foe. Late in the first day, Rozhestvensky was knocked out of action, taking a shell fragment directly to the head. And when I say knocked out of action, I mean literally knocked out, as in he was alive but unconscious. As evening approached, one of his subordinates, Rear Admiral Nabogatov, took command of the fleet. Fighting continued through the night and into the early hours of the next morning, when Nabogatov realized the battle's lost. He surrendered to the Japanese, knowing full well that he could be shot for doing so when he returned home. This battle was a huge victory for Japan. They were the first Eastern nation to defeat a European power. Russia lost 8 battleships, 9 cruisers, and a handful of other ships, with over 4,000 killed, including 3 of the admirals on the general staff. 7,300 plus Russians were captured as prisoners of war. In contrast, Japan lost 3 torpedo boats, had 116 deaths, and about 530 guys wounded. The remaining Russian ships were pursued until the evening of the 28th. Some were sunk, some captured, and only three managed to reach the safety of Vladivostok, where they remained blockaded until the end of the war. By the way, Rozhestvensky was sent to a Japanese hospital to recover from his head wound and returned home after the war, as did Nabokov. Neither man was shot when they returned to Russia, but both were put on trial. Rozhestvensky took full responsibility for the entire fiasco of the voyage and the humiliating loss in the battle. But because he had been unconscious from his wounds during the later parts of the battle, Tsar Nicholas II commuted his death sentence. Nabokov, who did the actual surrendering, was sent to prison and served a few years before the Tsar pardoned him. Regardless, both men's careers and reputations were ruined. Wow. So the Baltic Fleet was called upon to travel halfway around the world to salvage the dire situation in the Far East. What could have been an epic voyage and heroic rescue instead ended up being ridiculous and tragic. And of course, Russia's loss in the Russo-Japanese War led to all sorts of problems at home, including the revolution in 1905. But that's another story. And there you have it, kind listeners. Thank you for tuning in. You know, if you like the episode, please tell your friends about it. And I very much look forward to talking with you again in our next episode.